We'll go on to case number 5, which is 15-1865, and it is the United States versus John Henricks. Hi, Ms. Christensen.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. Good morning. Good morning. Still morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
Counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellant, John Henricks, in this matter. Today we're here to talk about a little used and little known statute, 3614. To be honest, until I came across this case, I had never seen it applied or used. So what we're arguing today is that the district court erred in finding that Mr. Henricks willfully failed to pay restitution, and that 3614 should be limited in usage to violations of supervised release and or probation, given the way it's been interpreted by the admittedly few courts who have interpreted it.
In other words, you think it can't be provided while he's in prison?
Correct. That's our position on that. And the reason for that goes to Bearden versus Georgia, which is where 3614 came from. And Bearden versus Georgia, of course, was a probation case, and the probation was premised on his payment of a fine. It was actually a relatively small fine of $600. And the whole case is about the purposes of probation and supervised release, although that was a probation case. Actually, I think before supervised release became a thing. So when Congress codified Bearden into 3614, our argument is that what they meant to do was make a statute that allowed the government to get an extra bite with more teeth, as this court held in Ike, for someone who fails to pay restitution.
Is this being argued for the first time on appeal?
I think that defense counsel hinted at it. I won't say that he made the argument that I'm making right now. I think that I have refined what he was trying to say. But I think he
For instance, did he ever use the term 3614?
Defense counsel? I'm sure he did. I mean, the government filed the motion under 3614.
Oh, okay.
So I'm sure everybody did. He did use the term Bearden versus Georgia. He compared the proceeding to a revocation proceeding for supervised release.
So your answer would be
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was preserved. And certainly I am refining it further. Did you have a question?
No, I'm just...
Okay. You look like you were burning.
I think I'm ready to say something. Yeah, probably, but okay. I'll wait for you to finish your point.
So, and if looking for case law on this issue, there are a couple cases that actually apply it while the defendant is incarcerated. But the vast majority are defendants who are on supervised release.
Yeah, but his problem was what he was doing while he was in prison on the phone negotiating with his arranged ex-wife about what to do with this, that, and the other thing. It wasn't like he was in prison while he was doing it.
He was in prison talking to his ex-wife, and I think that goes to the crux of the district court's willfulness finding, is the divorce proceedings with the now ex-wife. And the district court saw that as a sham divorce or a divorce of convenience to hide assets. The fact of the matter is there aren't really assets, certainly not assets that are unencumbered. That is probably part of the messy part of this case, is that almost all of these assets were encumbered by some mortgage or lien or loan that had been taken out with them secured.
As part of a design by the defendant, too.
I think most of the liens were prior to his charges in this case. Mortgages, the mortgage on the house I'm talking about, the liens on the equipment and the business.
Didn't the court make a factual finding that after he was in custody, after violating, he was on bond and then he revoked the bond, that after that point he continued to engage in essentially obstructive behavior with respect to his finances?
Yes, the court did make a finding.
Okay. And is there anything in the statute that prevents that? There's nothing in the statute that says it's limited to being on supervised release or probation, right?
No, that is not language in the statute. That's an interpretation we are pulling from where the statute came from. I fully admit that that Congress could have put that in the statute, but they do refer to 3614 in 3613A as one of the options for the district court when a defendant has failed to pay restitution, what the options for the court are. And most of them are something that we would ordinarily see in a revocation of probation or supervised release. I think that lends to our argument. And about the divorce, I think that the district court did make the finding that this was willful behavior on behalf of Mr. Henricks. But with ignoring the facts in the record that indicate that this was not willful behavior on his part, that the divorce, while it may look on paper that it was unequal, you have to look at the situation that the parties found themselves in.
Well, the court found that it was more than on paper. She, you know, looked at these conversations. And
right. Also, I mean, on paper. But looking at the fact that Mrs. Henricks maintained custody of their minor son, that her now ex-husband was going to prison for 10 years, and she was left essentially to clean it up. And I think Mr. Henricks...
Now 12 years.
At the time of the divorce, it was 10 years. Now 12 years. And Mr. Henricks was in a position where, very much so, I think, wanted to admit that he was responsible for the marriage debts, the party that... It was his conduct that those debts were, and he took them over during the marriage settlement. I think that is where this came from. Mrs. Henricks, who was going to remain, obviously, not in prison and care for their minor child, needed to have some assets, in Mr. Henricks' mind, to continue to care for his family. That's the primary finding that the district court made differently from the first sentencing to the second sentencing. Most of the findings made by the court were on facts that occurred prior to the first sentencing. He was denied acceptance of responsibility for not paying restitution. And he was then, his pretrial release, or I guess post-sentencing release, was revoked for failure to pay. And the only thing the court really considered was the divorce as being a sham divorce. So in addition to what we see is a reading of 3614 stemming from this court's decision in Ike and then Bearden versus Georgia as well, we don't think the district court should have the ability to impose an additional term of incarceration on someone who's already in prison. Unless the court has further questions, I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
How are you, Mr. O'Shea?
Good.
Haven't seen you in a while.
What? Yeah, well, it's a pleasure.
We sing this Christensen all the time.
There are two issues here, whether the district court was clearly erroneous in finding that Mr. Henricks was willful in disregarding the restitution order, and whether the district court plainly erred in resentencing Mr. Henricks. The district court was not clearly erroneous, and we're not here to reweigh the evidence, and there are five clear examples that we talk about in the government's brief, how we know that Mr. Henricks was willful. First of all, there was twice as much put into Mr. Henricks' commissary account than there was applied toward restitution, a little more than twice as much. Matter of fact, most of the money that was paid to restitution came in 2 weeks before Mr. Henricks was resentenced. Also, as the court knows, Mr. Henricks laundered tools through this Mac tool dealer. He got $11,620 worth of tools to set up this new business. You know, like Mr. Henricks, I think defense counsel is correct. He was trying to preserve assets for his wife and his son. He had a new house in a new town and a new business in a new town, new tools in the new town, and all that could have gone to pay restitution.
I noticed that, or I think I noticed, that neither your brief nor the district court stated exactly what it was in those prison exchanges between Mr. and Mrs. Henricks that caused Judge Crabb to think that the divorce was a ruse to hide his assets. Can Could you tell me what those exactly what those emails said? Could you refer me to the record?
I know in our brief number 105, we spend a lot of time talking about where in the record one can find those specific statements. I do know in my argument, they talked about. No, I apologize. I didn't cite in my record. I can supplement. I'll supplement the record and point the court to directly where. But it was the overall tone. They were. I do recall a conversation where Ms. Hendricks is saying, "Boy, you know, is there another way to do this without getting divorced to protect these assets?" But I'll supplement the record.
Is there another way to do this without
getting divorced?
Without getting divorced, yeah.
Yep.
So, and. You know, the defense argues that much of the tool laundering occurred before Mr. Hendricks was sentenced, and I respectfully submit that lots and lots of it occurred afterwards. But the other part is, look, these are hard things. These are durable goods of lasting value. Mr. Hendricks could have liquidated these tools at any time to pay restitution, but he chose not to. Could have sold them back to the Mac dealer or to somebody else. And then, of course, the Hendrickses rented their house. They spent that money, those more than $26,000 in state and federal tax refunds. Ms. Hendricks spent those or allocated to her in the divorce. And then lastly was the wildly unbalanced divorce agreement, clearly designed to keep any assets that did exist away from the victims of Mr. Hendricks's crimes and to keep them with his family. And my brief talks about that. But in detail, but Mr. Hendricks was left with $1.6 million of debts. Mrs. Hendricks, she obtained genuine assets, and she agreed to the debts associated with the assets she wanted to keep, the new business and the new house, all the other debts. $1.6 million were allocated to Mr. Hendricks. And then, in an apparent attempt to make the agreement seem equitable, they packed his side of the assets with just fluff, stuff that was made up, or things that had already been turned over to another bank. So I respectfully submit that the district court, you know, cannot be clearly erroneous. There's nothing in let's talk about the second issue. There's nothing in 3614 that suggests that it should never apply in a situation where a person serving his initial period of confinement. Bearden is different. Mr. Bearden was broke. He was indigent. The whole thing was about whether we can, in good conscience, send people to prison just because they can't pay. Are we going to have debtor's prison, essentially, in the United States? That wasn't the situation here. The PSR showed that Mr. Hendricks had $1.2 million worth of assets. You know, you would reasonably expect the United States to look and to try and collect on behalf of the victims. And the more we looked, the more we learned that Mr. Hendricks, by himself or through his wife, were engaging in these shenanigans to try and hide assets from the United States and from the victims. So I will supplement the record, Your Honor, but I appreciate you giving me your attention. Any other questions before I stop?
7 days?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Ms. Christensen, if you want to respond to whatever Mr. O'Shea's submission.
I assume what he's going to do is just simply submit the phone messages and text messages. And I'm aware of them, certainly.
Sex.
Yeah, I'm sorry, email, not text messages.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But if you want to know, respond.
I certainly will.
You know, take 7 days.
If I object to anything.
Okay.
I will address a couple of these items. You know, I think we can go back and forth, and we do in our brief quite a bit. The rent money obviously went to pay the mortgage. The mortgage on the residence was $2,200 a month. The rent was only $1,200 a month. That had to be made up. The government, of course, cannot expect Mr. Hendricks just to leave the residence empty and non-maintained, because it would devalue that asset that they are interested in collecting from as well. there's no dispute that these two had a hard time divorcing. I have not myself been divorced, but it's not an easy process for those of us who have been with anyone who has been. It's a lot of back and forth, and I think that what those emails and phone messages will sound like is two people who are having a really hard time after 20 years of marriage divorcing and dealing with the ramifications of not only their divorce, but Mr. Henrich's criminal behavior, which he fully admits occurred and he was responsible for. As far as I know, the federal tax return of $18,000 has not been spent. It is still in Mrs. Henrich's attorney's trust account. That may have changed, but the last I know in the record is that it is still there. The district court found Mr. Henrich's indigent in June of 2014 and appointed him counsel. I am, as the court is aware, appointed counsel. He has been found indigent. While he may have assets, again, they are encumbered, he did not have enough to pay for an attorney at that time, and in fact sold many of his assets to pay for the attorneys he had prior to that. The final note I will make is the pre-sentence report valuations were based on probably inflated or invalid valuations of his business and the property it sat on that were sold for much less. When you take down those valuations, the net worth becomes in the $100,000 range. And with the lack of income and other high expenses, it is unlikely Mr. Henrich's would have anything left aside from what he has already tried to pay for restitution. So unless the court has further questions, I ask the court to remand for resentencing.
Nope, nothing further I see.
Thank you.
And of course the case was taken under advisement, and you two have a good trip back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.